Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation and Litigation Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, September 27, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on Professor Josh Blackman's book entitled Unraveled, Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that the call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Professor Josh Blackman of the Houston College of Law, and Professor Nicholas Bagley, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law School. Thanks to both of you for joining us today, and with that, I will turn it over to Josh.
Well, thank you so much to the Federal Society for hosting me, and also to my good friend Nick Bagley for taking time out of his busy schedule. He's abroad in Switzerland this semester, so he's giving us a first-hand perspective of foreign healthcare law as well. Nick and I will have a discussion about my new book from Cambridge University Press, Unraveled, Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power, and afterwards we'll take some questions. So, Nick, I welcome the onslaught of your inquisitions.
I hope I will not make it an onslaught. I hope I keep it gentle. But I will open with a little bit of a needling question. So you call the book Unraveled, Josh, and it's an impressive piece of work. It really walks through some of the most heated debates over the Affordable Care Act that we've had since the decision in NFIB against Sebelius. And your last chapter in particular musters a lot of evidence for thinking that the Affordable Care Act's days may be numbered, that it may, as you say, unravel. But it seems to me that if you really kind of walk through the book and look at all the slings and arrows that have been cast at health reform, the message that comes through is that this law has been awfully resilient in the face of attack. And so some part of me wonders at this point whether the title of your book shouldn't have been something like Entrenchment or something along those lines, right?
Or unbreakable,
right? You know, President Obama said that the ACA is now part of the fabric of American life, and I kind of wonder about your views on that. And I'll offer one sort of piece of evidence to support the view that this is now unbreakable, as you say. Back when King against Burwell was about to be decided by the Supreme Court, there were a lot of very nervous congressional Republicans who were sending not-so-subtle messages to the court and to the public that if the Supreme Court were to rule in favor of the plaintiffs, they would have a very difficult political problem on their hand. They feared that they would be blamed for pitching millions of people off health insurance that they'd come to rely upon. They felt like they'd be in a really difficult political spot. And that makes me wonder whether, even if Donald Trump were to win the presidency and the Republicans were to, you know, maintain strong control of the Senate, makes me wonder if they really would take the, you know, controversial at this point step of undoing the ACA. Have we gotten to a point where instead of it being unraveled, it really is now entrenched?
Thank you, Nick. And that was a very good question, not inquisitorial, in fact. So the title for the book actually arose during the fall of 2013. This was a very hectic and chaotic period where within the span of 1 or 2 months, the website launched and crashed. You had the Senator Ted Cruz filibuster. You had the government shutdown. And you had millions of cancellation notices. And a word that kept being thrown around was this law is unraveling. A lot of newspapers used it. And then the following year, when King v. Burwell was being considered, the subsidies case, President Obama said, it seems so cynical to want to take away coverage from millions of people to, quote, unravel what's now being woven into the fabric of America. And I had already picked the title at that point. But I think what this represents is, in many respects, the ACA is here to stay. Right, in large measure, a few things are here to stay. The idea that people can buy health insurance regardless of their pre-existing conditions, that's here to stay. The idea that people can now buy insurance on these online exchanges, that's here to stay. Beyond that, though, I think a lot of stuff is somewhat in flux. And what do I mean by that? Republican efforts to kill the ACA have, by and large, failed. And I think, for the most part, they haven't had a meaningful replacement online. So a lot of these efforts were perfunctory. You know, they have had 50-something repeal votes in the House, knowing that this would never go to step one in the Senate. And I think you're right. A lot of congressional Republicans were afraid of the Supreme Court striking down the IRS rule. But that doesn't mean that the ACA is indeed out of the woods. I wouldn't quite go as far to call it unbreakable yet. In fact, I think it's quite broken. There were several major premises that this law was built upon, that if we have the right level of mandates with the right level of subsidies, you would have this dynamic marketplace that would sustain itself, and all these young millennials would sign up and get health insurance, and you have just the right balance with old and sick people with young people, and then all the insurance companies would be profitable. And I think that, for the most part, that hasn't happened. And I think the canary in the coal mine is in a number of states, you're down to one or maybe even in some places perhaps zero insurers left in the marketplace because these are not profitable policies to be sold. So even though I think that core components of the ACA are here, the law as designed by the experts, Jonathan Gruber and others, that hasn't quite panned out. So healthcare reform is not going anywhere, but it may exist in name only as we move forward.
Fair enough, fair enough. You know, I want to ask, follow up just on that, briefly, you know, when it comes to the exchanges, you said, well, gosh, you know, maybe the, you know, the mix of the mandate and the subsidies isn't right to get people onto the market who are not, you know, to get healthy people onto the market. I suppose I sort of wonder, you know, if you believe that community rating is here to stay and that people are going to be able to buy insurance without any kind of regard, without regard to pre-existing conditions and the like, doesn't it seem like the only way to sustain a private market along those lines would be to encourage or force, although it's a bit of a dirty word, healthy people into the exchanges? And if so, I mean, wouldn't the policy prescription that follows be that we should increase the mandate or that we should increase the subsidies? Or do you think that instead we're just going to see this kind of ramshackle contraption that doesn't really work kind of persist and kind of linger on in a less than optimal state?
That's a very good question. The short answer is I think there was a decision that was made in 2009. And if you flash back, you recall that Al Franken, when he had his election finally wrapped, I think it was in June of 2009, the Democrats had their 60 votes. And there were good faith efforts to try to bring Republicans along to support the reform. And they simply weren't interested. They were not interested in supporting this law. So the president made the decision, and this was a momentous decision, to say, you know what, we're going to go alone with 60 votes, and hopefully everyone will fall in line. I described this recently in the National Review as an arrogant decision. The presumption that once we pass this, people come along and tweak this and tweak that and make amendments, I think was foolish. And because of that, we don't see any movement from Republicans who want to say, well, let's increase the subsidies, let's do this to improve it. You have roughly half the congressional caucus whose intent to see this law implode. So on the one hand, I don't see Congress moving to increase the subsidies. On the second hand, making the mandate more severe, I think that actually may run afoul of the saving construction. I think it would be unconstitutional to have a really stiff penalty where people don't have a meaningful choice. I think you actually have a constitutional avoidance problems there. So the decision to pass this in its incomplete form, which was a decision urged by Gruber and others, was a costly one. And now we're in the situation where you're not going to see efforts to try and tweak it. So we have this sort of ramshackle contraption, as you called it. And unless you turn to executive action, which I hope we get to later, you're not getting any meaningful changes in the law.
Yeah, no, I take all those points. And I think it is absolutely true that we've not seen social change on this kind of scale be pushed through over such ardent opposition from an opposing party without any kind of buy-in, doing it solely along partisan lines. I'm always tempted to respond when I hear that line of criticism that, you know, a president who has an electoral mandate and has a sympathetic Congress has a responsibility to do what he can to advance his agenda. I mean, that's the democratically responsive thing to do. And so, you know, if you've got, you know, polarized politics where it's sort of zero-sum game and the other side is simply trying to tear you down so you don't, you know, so they can reap an advantage on their own, you know, it may be the right thing to do in those circumstances is to go it alone. Certainly if the shoe was on the other foot, I would expect Republicans to push forward their agenda pretty forcefully. But that said, you're absolutely right that there was a kind of poisoning of the well that occurred, or a perception at least of a poisoning of the well that occurred because of the doing this along partisan lines. One question I have for you is, do you think that the antipathy toward health reform, or that kind of relentless focus on health reform, is starting to dim a little bit? You know, it wasn't mentioned at all in last night's debate. Donald Trump doesn't seem to be a healthcare expert along any dimension. What he said about healthcare has been confused and actually not entirely unsympathetic to the goals of the Affordable Care Act. Do you think we're watching the importance of this issue recede, or do you think it's just slumbering during a very unusual political campaign?
Oh, I have an entire chapter in my book about Donald Trump and healthcare reform. He has been all over the map. Until very recently, he supported single payer. Even during the debates in the Republican primary, he said he would want everyone to be covered, which is effectively some sort of national healthcare system. I think making fun of Donald Trump's policy choices is a bit too easy. We'll get giddy like Hillary if we start doing that. But the short answer is, until we come to grips with how to make healthcare reform work, I think all these discussions are meaningless. And let me be very specific here. When the president was selling the law, he told a lie, and I call it a lie in the book, that if you like your plan, you can keep your plan. The reason why this lie was told was because he didn't want people to think they would have to sacrifice what they have. This was simply impossible. The way we make healthcare affordable for older and sicker people is by making it more expensive for younger and healthier people. There's no way around that. You can't avoid that. So to make this work, there has to be some sort of self-sacrifice. You have to acknowledge that the Cadillac tax will maybe get rid of your gold-plated plan. You have to acknowledge that you can't keep your emergency plan that covers only hospital visits. You're not going to be able to keep a plan that doesn't cover things. It will be more expensive. And all those things require sacrifice, and the American people don't want to sacrifice. Even when the Cadillac tax came up, we've now delayed it 2 years, so now people want to feel the brunt of that. We've also had a situation where people's plans were canceled, and through executive action that I think was illegal, the president's grandfathered all these old plans. This has been going on nearly for 3 years, so we're having this false sense of complacency where perhaps it's as bad as it may make it seem. A lot of the most painful parts of the law have never been felt. But due to the nature of these executive actions, that winds up next year. Starting 2017, the grandfathering goes away. The employer mandate starts to kick in full force. And we're starting to see a lot of the more painful parts of this law be felt. So we have Barack Obama, J.D., writing in the Journal of the American Medical Association, we need single payer. And with Hillary Clinton saying public option. And with Hillary Clinton saying we need a public option. Unless they eliminate the filibuster, this has no shot of passing. But we've already seen in 3 years that the subtle nuances of the marketplace haven't worked out, and now we're turning to a government plan to compete. I don't think this can pass under normal circumstances, but we're already seeing these glimmers of acknowledging that this isn't quite working out.
Yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly that the public option is DOA in Congress. I also have real skepticism that the public option is would be the salvation of what ails the exchanges. I'm a little bit more on the fence about whether or not I see the same deep infirmities in the market that you do. I think you're right that there are some troubling trends with insurers and single insurers in some of the markets. But there are also lots of states and lots of counties in which the exchanges work quite well, and it's not clear to anybody whether the jumping of the rates in 2017 is a one-time adjustment or is really the beginning of a longer-term death spiral. But actually, that brings me to the next question I want to ask you, which is that this book is, you know, although you have a political view that you're quite upfront about, quite firm-minded in the effort to present both sides of the argument, to try to be a neutral observer, to try to simply call it like it is. And I sort of wanted to ask you about that gap between what you admit is your advocacy role as a lawyer who's participating in these cases, who's writing blogs that Supreme Court justices do read, right? On the one hand, you've got this advocacy hat. On the other hand, you've got this I'm just an academic telling you what happened hat. I wondered if you could say something about how you negotiated that tension in writing the book and in writing your blog and sort of thinking about the role that you occupy as a public figure.
Thank you. So I'll give a writing tip for everyone on the line. Don't use adjectives or adverbs. The easiest way to write neutrally is to describe words with nouns. Don't use adjectives or adverbs. You can live by it. But to answer the question more fundamentally, when I wrote my first book, Unprecedented, at the time I was a law clerk and I hadn't started teaching. So I describe myself as a sort of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, where I'm there at all the right moments, but I don't actually do anything. I'm simply observing. That was not the case.
And you're murdered in England at the end?
Yeah, something very rotten. And you're in Switzerland, but close enough. But the issue here is that I was actively involved in the case. I wrote several briefs for Cato in the King v. Burwell case, in the Little Sisters of the Poor litigation. I've written numerous briefs. I mentioned this anecdote in the book, but at one point I mailed copies of my book to all the justices, and one of them wrote back saying that the justice reads my blog, which I thought was pretty cool. And then it's like, oh my God, they're reading my blog. So at the same moment, you realize that you're having an impact on the case. So what I tried to do as hard as I can was to have people like Nick and others who, and you know, Tim Jost and people who I know will not agree with me to read my stuff and try to make sure it's as neutral as possible. What I also tried to do is something I wish more professors would do, is acknowledge their impact. I can't tell you how many law review articles I read where people who wrote amicus briefs in cases don't even acknowledge it. In fact, I have a piece coming out in the Harvard Law Review next month, and the very first footnote lists every brief I wrote in the Obamacare litigation, because I want to be very candid about my prior beliefs. I think that's a good practice. Did I succeed on that front? I will let Nick and others judge me on that, but I really tried hard to write a history book that in 20 years, if you want to see, you know, what happened with the Obamacare litigation in these years, go read Josh's book, and that was my overriding motivation.
I think by and large you succeeded, Josh. I think it's a testament in these hyperpolarized times to your integrity. It really does read, pretty even-handedly. And it's really hard to do that in a world where, you know, the other side is so relentlessly villainized. I wanted to turn from that to actually ask you about sort of the kind of critical figure in your book. And it's a figure about whom we know both a great deal and not enough, which is to say Chief Justice Roberts. So he obviously cast the deciding vote in NFIB. He was central to the decision in King against Burwell. He's really been sort of the moving actor here. And he's taken a lot of heat from that, heat on that front from the right for being, a traitor to the cause or insufficiently committed to conservative principles, whether they be conservative constitutional principles or conservative statutory principles. He's been pilloried as being sort of by Justice Scalia, no less, as a secret supporter of the Affordable Care Act, somebody who's bent on preserving it against attack in the courts. On the other hand, he's been lauded by some Republicans as well as being careful to husband the integrity of the court, not to waste its institutional authority on partisan fights. And I'm sort of curious where you come down on this front, whether you think, you know, sort of what motivates the Chief Justice in these cases? What's driving him?
I wrote a piece before Justice Scalia passed where I describe Chief Justice Roberts' reasoning in the terms of F.A. Hayek as a fatal conceit. And what do I mean by that? He definitely has a vision of where he wants to move and shape the court. He likes this minimalism, this incrementalism. But I think it's purely fanciful because, as we've seen with the loss of one vote, Justice Scalia, I mean, there's now the chance that Roberts will be in dissent for the next 30 years. And now Adam Liptak and others are writing the Times. Well, maybe he'll moderate like Chief Justice Rehnquist and move to the left so he'll be in the majority. I think any efforts by the justices to play this sort of long game is foolhardy because you never know who the next justice will retire or pass away is. But the Chief Justice, for better or worse, has decided that he did not want the court to be at the center of this brewing storm. Even the very last or the penultimate paragraph in King v. Burwell, he said, the purpose of health care reform is to improve health insurance, not destroy it, and we will interpret it in that fashion. In the last paragraph of his decision in NFIB Sebelius, he said, you know, we are not here to protect the people from the consequences of their decision. So he has this almost a knee-jerk reaction not to get involved in these sorts of cases. But there's, you can even see there's this almost level of discomfort in his writing. You know, he says, well, yeah, this is not really a tax, but we'll treat it as a tax to uphold it. And, well, the plain meaning of established by the state is good, but, you know, there's these other purposivist arguments there. And there's this tension in him. You know, it's almost conflicted. You know, we could have a Shakespearean, like Hamlet almost. You know, he's conflicted. You know, to tax or not to tax, that is the question, right? Where are we going with this? And I think now he's somewhat adrift without a mooring because he will not be in the majority for, perhaps I'm assuming the question, but there's a very good chance he will not be in the majority, and whatever his visions were for the court, I think will be gone awry. So, his strategy is gone for the ages. As for me, teaching his decisions are very difficult. His decision in FAB still gives me heartburn. My friend Ilya Shapiro still has not gotten over it, neither have I. And now teaching his decision in King v. Burwell, and even this past year, we had the Little Sisters of the Poor bizarre per curiam order that resolved very little. So the ACA, to quote Justice Scalia, has been a special place for the Supreme Court, a safe space maybe, where all the usual rules seem not to apply.
Well, you know, so I'm sort of, I just want to push you on this because, you know, I asked the question and you came back and really characterized the Chief Justice as being somebody who's strategic, thinking long-term about the institution, thinking long-term about where he can bend the court, where he wants to go. And this is a vision of a justice that's quite different from the balls and strikes referee that the Chief Justice talked about during his confirmation hearings. And so I want to offer just a possible reading of his opinions, which is maybe he ruled the way he did in NFIB because he thought actually that it really was a tax. And maybe he ruled in favor of the government in King against Burwell because he thought that actually on balance they had the better interpretation of the statute. I mean, is it possible that these aren't reflections of a long-term strategic gambit gone awry, as you seem to describe it, and simply his effort to call balls and strikes, whether that makes him popular at certain cocktail parties?
Well, you know, he denied ever being a member of the Federal Society, so I don't think he's invited to these parties anymore. But I think the short answer is his decision in the first Obamacare case. He spent nearly 20 pages talking about the Commerce Clause and then said, oh, but all that's utterly irrelevant because we'll uphold it as a tax, or we'll save it as a tax, to be more precise. I'd love to simply give him the benefit of the doubt, but I think he has some sort of broader a vision of where he wants to shape the law. If he didn't, there's no reason why he would write that lengthy Commerce Clause analysis in NFIB. In King against Burwell, and we can maybe get into the weeds of that case because you and I have gone back and forth on that. He went out of his way not to decide this on Chevron grounds. And he made this point during argument. Why? Because the next president could simply reverse it and rule that the rule means something else. He wanted to rule it on the statutory grounds. I think he was basically one other circuit judge ruled in that manner in King. Most judges have simply said Chevron deference and be done with it. So he's definitely trying to do something more than balls and strikes. But, you know, maybe in 40 years we'll get his papers and you and I will laugh about it. But for the time being, I'll stick with it.
Well, you know, it's funny. The Chevron holding in King was surprising to a lot of observers. But actually that is of a piece with a broader effort that the Chief has pushed to cut back on the deferential attitude that courts take to agencies that make big decisions. You know, he's not a lover of Chevron. So I didn't view that as sort of an effort to take this out of the realm of politics or to shield the ACA. I took that as a stepwise effort for him to entrench his views about administrative law. It had, I think, very little to do with the Affordable Care Act. But as you say, we will open his papers in a couple of decades and sort of see what we find. I did want to actually pivot just a little bit away from King, although Lord knows I am happy to go back and talk ad nauseum about that case, and ask a little bit about Little Sisters of the Poor and the decision to boot this case back down to the parties to try to hammer out a settlement. And I gather, although I've not been following it nearly as closely as you have, that the parties are still trying to hammer out a settlement, some kind of accommodation that would allow women who work for religious organizations to receive birth control, but would also honor and respect the religious beliefs of their employers. And I was curious, if we're close to a settlement, what, if you think you kind of know what that settlement looks like, whether any settlement is possible, and what motivated the court in this very strange order to the parties to, I don't know, make nice with each other?
Well, so excellent question. The Zubik litigation, which is most commonly known as Little Sisters of the Poor, reflected an aspect of the ACA. Now, this is a fact I discussed in the book that I'm sure most people don't know, but the Affordable Care Act that Congress voted on does not have a contraceptive mandate. I'll say it again. The ACA does not have a contraceptive mandate. Rather, all the ACA says is that employers have to provide for women, quote, preventive care. What is preventive care? Well, Congress wrote a blank check to an agency to interpret that ambiguous term. It said, well, of course, preventive care means the entire full range of birth control products approved by the FDA. That is not inherently problematic, but as drafted, the ACA has absolutely no conscience clause for this. For example, if you are a certain religious adherent, for example, a member of an Amish sect, you are actually exempt from the individual mandate. This came up in the first litigation. You are exempt from the mandate because Congress created a very specific carve-out for certain religious sects. Congress was totally silent on the employer mandate. So as drafted, the ACA basically requires all employers, including churches and everyone else, to pay for birth control for their female employees. So the Obama administration issued a series of rulemakings. In fact, I totaled about six if you count all of them. But the first go-around said, well, if you're a church and you primarily cater to people of your own faith, then you can be exempted. But if you were a church who ran a soup kitchen and you didn't check baptismal certificates at the door, you were not exempted. Okay, that didn't go over so well. So the second said, okay, if you are a religious charity, you're not going to have to pay for it, but the insurance company will pay for these products, and oh, by the way, we'll use your product. So the Little Sisters and the group said, well, you know, you're hijacking our insurance policies. The hardest part of this book was because this involves ERISA. And under ERISA, depending on the type of plan you have, the interaction between the employer and the insurer is different. And to put a fine point on it, the Little Sisters have what's called a church plan under ERISA. And under ERISA, they can't be required to comply with this, so they're not even the true plaintiff. The true plaintiffs are those who have what's called self-insurance, where they have their own insurance policy. So after the Supreme Court case was argued in March, I was there sitting front row. The justices had this unprecedented order. They said, hey, we want to have more briefing on this issue, right? Can you guys maybe work out a policy where the employer doesn't quite object, but they say we don't want this and that? The entire process, and I discuss this at length in the book, was foolhardy. The reason why is there's a very fundamental divide between the parties. The government wants what they call seamless coverage. Seamless coverage. What does this mean? The female employee gets the same coverage through the same doctors without having a separate card, no extra work. The religious employers say, well, just use a separate policy, the same way you have a prescription card or a dental card, use a separate card, or maybe offer a contraceptive policy on the Obamacare exchanges. This is a grand chasm of a gap. They simply do not agree on this. And ultimately, the courts of appeals are saddled with this intractable task of deciding whether putting them on the same policy creates a substantial burden under RFRA, or perhaps whether they could do something else. But I don't see, with respect to these self-insured plans, a compromise anytime soon. There might be compromises with the other types of ERISA plans, but not the self-insured plans. I know this. People want to talk about religious liberty, but this is really an ERISA question, which sounds absolutely insane.
Well, it actually kind of brings me, I mean, it sounds like we're not hearing the end of these religious liberty disputes anytime soon. And I guess just pulling back, and if I can ask you to put on your prognosticator cap, are we kind of watching, I guess, the last gasps of efforts to undermine the Affordable Care Act in the courts, and we're, you know, about to turn the page? Or is this just, you know, are you going to have a ton of new material for this third book that you hope to write, and you might get to write a fourth and a fifth all in the same vein? Is this the beginning of the end, or is this just the beginning of more to come?
I don't think litigation will be the gravamen of the future ACA books I'll have to write. I mean, there's a few big cases. So the House of Representatives suit is a biggie. this, and Nick actually and I agree on the merits here, effectively the ACA provides certain types of subsidies to insurance companies. And in 2014, the Senate Democrats, and this is actually a Democrat move, decided not to appropriate any money for this specific type of subsidy. Why did they do this? Because it would have been subject to the sequester, and the insurance companies would have only received at 90 cents on the dollar. So rather than going through the sequestration, the Obama administration, out of thin air, said, "Oh well, we have this other source, this other type of subsidy that we can use this to cover." This is wrong, and Nick and I agree on the merits, but we disagree on the standing. So the House of Representatives sued on this question, and the district judge in D.C. said, "Yes, they're standing, and yes, these payments are illegal." Even if the House is successful, this won't, you know, unravel Obamacare. It'll take a huge hit out of it. But this is a serious case. But going forward, the ACA's biggest enemy is itself, right? It's not going to be John Roberts striking it down. It's not going to be, you know, a federal site lawyers taking it down. It's going to be, can this law be sustainable on its own? And if there's a Clinton presidency, will they try and use a public option to prop it up? If there's a Trump presidency, who the hell knows? But in its current state, it's wobbling. And there are certain inefficiencies in how it's operating that, unless you get bicameralism presentment, executive action becomes the only way of even trying to stabilize, I think. But I think at this point you're putting Band-Aid upon top of Band-Aid or plugging one hole on top of the other, and it's not going to work the way perhaps Gruber and others had intended it to.
Yeah, let me actually kind of push you a little bit on that, on the point about executive action. You know, as you say, you and I agree that the administration doesn't have the authority to make these cost-sharing reduction payments, at least under the theory that it's espoused in the courts. And that's trouble. And it's a reflection of, an Obama presidency that is committed to the success of this law and a Congress that has refused to play ball. At every turn, it's put him into a position where he feels like he has no other choice but to invoke executive power. And I guess I want to ask you how that relates to the standing inquiry. I think it's difficult to read the Supreme Court's cases and think that the House of Representatives has standing to sue here. It's not impossible. There's no directly on-square precedent saying that they don't, but there are lots of clues that this is the kind of lawsuit that really oughtn't be in the courts, not least of which that there has been no appropriations case like this that's ever seen the inside of a courtroom. And so I'm curious about your view that in fact, the House of Representatives does have standing. Is this simply a, we've got to make standing for the House because otherwise it'll be an imperial president, or is this sort of a careful effort to read the existing precedents and find a clear line through standing law, if such a clear line can possibly be divined, that yields standing for the House of Representatives?
Sure. And I have a chapter on this in my book called So Sue Me, All About the President's Actions. I think what my general philosophy, and this goes way before the ACA, is that standing law is far too restrictive. When you have a clear separation of powers violation, which I think you have here, it's jarring to think that the president can do it simply because courts have no standing. And specifically with respect to appropriations, the biggest check Congress has is, in fact, the power of the purse. And if the president can simply spend money that Congress has not appropriated, again, this is not Republicans playing hardball. Tom Vilsack was the one who cut this appropriation to avoid sequestration. This is actually not that case. But when you have a clear instance where the president's spending money that's not allowed, and I'll give you an example. So there was another case called West Virginia versus HHS brought by the Attorney General Morrissey in West Virginia. And this case challenges a so-called administrative fix to Obamacare. And what's this? This is the, if you like your plan, you can keep your plan fixed. In 2013, millions of people got these cancellation notices. Why? Because Obamacare made it harder to renew their plans. Okay. So the president said to the states and to insurance companies, if you guys want to allow these old policies that are not compliant to be sold, keep selling them. Okay. This is a really, really clear violation of the ACA. The ACA has these minimum essential coverage requirements. They cannot be waived in this massive function. Ultimately, the courts ruled against West Virginia. They said there was no standing. But there was one point during the argument, I think it was Judge Silberman asked Elbert Lind, who is the AG, I'm sorry, the Solicitor General of West Virginia. He said something, Silberman asked the government lawyer the DOJ lawyer, said, you know, did you guys think that no one could stop you, right? Did you think that no one would have standing when you did this? And I think the answer has to be yes. I can imagine a DOJ lawyer telling the president, well, this is probably illegal, but there's no standing to stop you. And that scares me. If the only answer the government has is no one can stop us, then we are imperial. And in this case, I think it warrants a close reexamination of standing jurisprudence. I have a piece in the Harvard Law Review called Gridlock, another one coming out. It's on draft called Presidential Maladministration. When you have the executive doing stuff and Congress can't stop it because there's no funding issue, I think that warrants a strong revisiting of standing doctrine and to perhaps get some light on these actions.
Yeah. I'm not sympathetic to that argument myself. And I, you know, it goes to my general reluctance to enable courts to interfere in executive action. I think it creates more problems than it solves. And a general willingness to look past the courts in looking for enforcement options. You know, I think there's this temptation as lawyers to say, well, gosh, if the courts can't enforce the law, then how is the law going to be enforced? Well, it turns out that we do enforce the law through the political branches pretty effectively, but you are absolutely correct that many of those political checks on executive power have withered as the rise of partisanship has made politics into more of a zero-sum game. But I think actually with that, Josh, I'd be inclined to open up the discussion to the audience if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. We can dial back and banter a bit more if depending what comes up in the Q&A.
Yeah, okay, that sounds fine. I'm now going to open the floor to questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt that says the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor and join the queue, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. And we'll get to your questions, the order in which they are received. While we wait for some questions to queue up, let me make a quick programming note. Our next Teleform call is scheduled for this Thursday at 3:30 p.m. That's going to be on JCPOA, 1 year in review, sponsored by our International and National Security Law Practice Group. And with that, let's go ahead and move to our first caller. Go ahead, caller, you have the floor.
Hi, this is Mike Stern in Washington, D.C. Thank you both for this very interesting presentation. I could ask many questions, but I'm only going to ask one. Apparently, there is now a suggestion that with respect to the House of Representatives lawsuit that if the House ends up winning, that the money that was not appropriated cannot be paid through the normal process, that executive branch, well, that the insurance companies might use the Tucker Act or something to sue, and then that the administration would basically use the judgment fund to settle those suits and therefore pay them the same money that the court basically would prevent them from paying directly. Do you all have thoughts on that? I know Nick has written some stuff about
it. Yeah, I'll go first, and I'll let Nick correct me. I think, so what's happening here is that the insurance companies have said, look, you've promised us these subsidies, and it's a significant chunk of change. It's a lot of money. Even though it's not appropriated, we're going to sue you under various claims laws, like the Tucker Act, and then you're going to pay us at the judgment fund. Now, the judgment fund is what's called a permanent appropriation. It's basically an unlimited pot of money. I mean, it's not unlimited, but it's never ending. The government has recently hinted in a few, you know, regulations that they're not going to litigate these cases so vociferously because at some point they say we're going to owe this money, so why waste time? The House of Representatives has created some murmurings about this, saying, well, we don't agree that if Congress doesn't appropriate the funding for it, you can't use a judgment fund to bypass them. In fact, I fully expect the House to intervene in this litigation in the event that the Obama DOJ says, okay, we're going to settle, which we're going to get rid of this. Even if Nick is correct, and I think he might be, that you can get this sort of funding from the judgment fund, we should reconsider this. If Congress is going to start deappropriating money and the president can just go through this sue and settle practice to get around that, that's a very dangerous precedent. But I'm not fully studied on whether Nick is correct, but he very well may be. So, Nick, do you want to chime in?
Yeah,
here?
I'm happy to. So this fight over whether or not you can go to the Court of Federal Claims under the Tucker Act is actually playing out with respect to the Risk Corridor program under the ACA. I will leave the details of the Risk Corridor program to one side, and you can thank me later. But what I can say is that it's the same. Structurally, the problem is the same, that the federal government has made a promise, that the promise creates an entitlement, that the entitlement can be sued upon in the Court of Federal Claims, and any recovery can then come from the judgment fund, just like any other recovery against the United States. What makes these cases different, of course, is the magnitude of the kinds of judgments that we're talking about. The judgment fund does occasionally pay out billion-dollar settlements. It's not unheard of, but we're talking even more money than that and in a very superheated environment. The Republicans in Congress have argued, well, no, health plans don't have an entitlement either to the cost-sharing reductions or the Risk Corridor program. I think those claims are thin. I think the Affordable Care Act did make these promises, and I think so far congressional Republicans haven't been able to undo them, however much they wished they could. Same thing with the judgment fund. The judgment fund is available unless payment is otherwise provided for, and payment being otherwise provided for requires Congress to designate an alternative source of funds to make these kinds of payments. And Congress hasn't yet identified an alternative source of funds that would displace the judgment fund. So, yes, the judgment fund seems to be available to make both the cost-sharing reductions and the risk corridor payments down the line. It is always within Congress's power to shut down the judgment fund, and I expect to see more interest in that as time goes on. And in fact, I think if we get a President Trump, I think it's reasonably likely we'll see something like that enacted. In the meantime, you know, is the judgment fund giving the executive branch a great deal of authority to settle lots of cases that have been brought against it? Sure. But that was the point of the judgment fund. Originally, it was capped at $100,000. But that meant that any time there was a big claim against the U.S., the plaintiff had to go running to Congress to get a private bill enacted to get the judgment paid. And Congress thought that was a pain in the butt. And so Congress said, you know what? We understand that this will give the executive branch some of our power of the purse. It will allow it to exercise some power to spend money without our direct superintendence. But we're comfortable with that trade-off in this context. And until they revisit that determination, I think this kind of reimbursement, this effort to get money through the courts is likely to prove successful.
All right, we're going to move right along to our next caller.
This is Eric Mead in Florida. I'd like to ask a question about the broader questions of executive authority and the actions that have been taken, because I see in my practice as things are going on in terms of voluntary compliance, a real significant shift. I've been practicing since the mid-90s. And the sense of a lot of, particularly employers, but of a lot of other people, is shifting from, compliance as a de rigueur kind of thing to, I'll avoid attention if I can, and I don't believe what they say. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that crisis of legitimacy that I see creeping into a lot of those issues in terms of how law is being put forward by this administration, clearly, but I think broader than that. I think it goes even back to the Bush administration, Bush 41, and maybe even a bit of Reagan. But what are your thoughts on that?
So I think the broader issue here can be summarized in a Saturday Night Live skit from a couple years ago. So everyone remember the Schoolhouse Rock theme song, How a Bill Becomes a Law. Remember, it's a little bill sitting on the steps of Capitol Hill, and it gets passed by both houses. So SNL did a parody where they said, well, we don't pass bills anymore, this executive order. And you have this executive order kicking the bill down the steps of Capitol Hill. I think the most pernicious aspect of the pen and phone strategy is not just on the rule of law, which is awful, but also on teaching students that the way to bypass gridlock and intransigence is through executive action. I had a student a couple of years ago. I asked him a question. I said, what happens if the Congress won't pass the bill the president wants? And he said, well, he can sign an executive order. And that answer just gobsmacked me. It made me very sad all at once. We looked at Justice Scalia, our patron saint. In the case of NLRB v. Noel Canning, he said that intransigence, gridlock, is a feature, not a bug of our republic, right? When we have a very divided populace, the necessary result is that Congress grinds to a halt. We don't have a parliamentary system where whenever we have a no-confidence vote, we have new government put in on the fly. We don't have that. And for the president to simply turn to executive action and get drunk with power, as I think has been the last few years, it sets a very dangerous precedent. And I'll say nothing more about Donald Trump than imagine Donald Trump using a Barack Obama's pen and phone. It's a frightening thought to me, and I'm sure many others on this call would agree. And you will see a sudden, if Trump wins next month, you will see a sudden reversal of all scholars saying, well, we need to rethink executive power. Maybe we need standing at the challenges in court and all this other stuff. But be very careful when the answer to any political problem is an executive order or some other memorandum.
Okay, our lines are wide open. Once again, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. Nick, is there a line of – oh, actually, we just had somebody join the queue, so let's go to another caller.
This is Will Trackman at Littler Mendelson in Denver. I just had a question as a practical matter. What happens? I know Pima County, Arizona doesn't have any exchanges. It sounds like a lot of other health insurers are opting, instead of raising rates, just to withdraw from the exchanges, UHC being one of the more prominent examples. At what point would the ACA actually unravel completely? Is it another few insurers? Are we a long way away? How close are we?
Right. So the question is, I get this question all the time, at what point does this thing blow up? And there's not going to be a single instant, like, you know, the event horizon of Obamacare. It won't happen like that. What we'll see is very slow and gradual implosions. The Pima County, Arizona one was an instance where you only had one insurer left in the state, in this county, then it ducked out. Fortunately, the state was able to work out a deal with Blue Cross Blue Shield to stick around. But the consequence of that is that now the state basically has to approve whatever rate hike the insurer wants, because otherwise they lose it altogether. The bigger canary in the coal mine is not Arizona, but Alaska. Alaska had one provider, Blue Cross, and what ended up happening was that Blue Cross said, we want this rate hike. Alaska said no. So the insurer said, okay, we're leaving the state. At the last minute, the legislature had to make this like $50 million slush fund to basically pay off this insurer to stay. You'll start seeing this. So in a lot of states, you know, California, Oregon, a few others, you're actually having vibrant markets. In other states, they're absolutely abysmal. So there's no nationwide death spiral. You're going to see this really on a county-by-county basis where people are stuck with only one or two plans that have very high deductibles and not very good coverage. And I think what we'll see is the enrollment numbers plateau. As recently as 2015, the government projected 20 million people would sign up on Obamacare for health care. The number is closer to 10 or 11, depending how you count. So we're nowhere near the expected risk pool. So it's not going to implode. It's simply going to muddle along, and in certain counties, it'll be impossible to buy insurance that's actually useful. So that's why it's really hard to say at what point does this all blow up. The biggest change would be if indeed Hillary Clinton can push through a public option. At that point, I think most of the private insurers will simply pack up and exit the market. My friend Seth Chandler, who teaches at the University of Houston, has compared the public option to a Trojan horse with windows. You know exactly what this is. It's a pavement to Medicare for all, as Bernie Sanders has been railing about now for years. That's the next big move. Otherwise, this will simply muddle along. It won't be improved by a statute because Congress can't pass bills anymore, and we'll be in this weird spot where people are not getting good coverage, and the rates keep going up, and it'll just become a new fact of life.
Well, I'll just follow up on that, Josh, and sort of maybe needle you again a little bit, which is if that's the sort of way of the future, if that's a status quo going forward, that the statute kind of limps along and it doesn't work very well, you know, there's a good claim to say that's not tenable, that long-term, like, there's going to be something that's got to change. And so Hillary Clinton, perhaps her public option is a Trojan horse with windows. We can debate about that. But I think it's safe to say that sort of a more public-oriented health version of healthcare reform could be in the offing. And you've said before, when we started this conversation, that we can't go back to a world where we had just experience rating, that community rating is here to stay. And so I guess I'm sort of wondering, like, what, you know, what's the Republican strategy going forward? If the alternative looks like a system that doesn't work versus a public system, I would have thought that maybe the response would be, let's go all in on getting these private exchanges to work, because at least it's a private market that can yield some of the advantages of, you know, the private sphere that we've long been enamored of. It seems to me that at least one plausible outcome to the relentless opposition to the Affordable Care Act is actually a more public health insurance system than the one that the Affordable Care Act devises.
Yeah, and this has been one of my biggest frustrations of the entire ACA battle, is that, and I say this with respect, but Republicans have not been serious about what they would replace it with. And, you know, we've seen these various blueprints and white papers, but there hasn't been something meaningful that accounts for the two key facts. You're not taking coverage away from people who like it, and you're not denying coverage to people who have various conditions. In this front, even though the president made an arrogant decision to go it alone, he won the bigger battle of changing the sort of societal expectation. And to use a phrase Nick used earlier, you do have entrenchment. And it's almost impossible to unentrench, if that's even a word, but entrench a social entitlement program. And tragically, I've not seen anything from the Trump campaign that persuades me otherwise. Now, Paul Ryan has something, I think the road away from Obamacare, the pathway from Obamacare. I don't see any bill unless you get rid of the filibuster passing through. So we're basically stuck with this. And because Republicans have such a deep-seated opposition, I don't see them supporting any of the aspects of the law that may be beneficial to avoid a single-payer system. I mentioned Hayek earlier with the fatal conceit. To use another Hayek chestnut, you have the road to serfdom. I think maybe we're just trickling along towards a national healthcare system. We put off the inevitable for several decades. But at this point, the decision made in 2009 to do this, I think will have lingering effects. And John Roberts wasn't going to stop it. Mitt Romney couldn't stop it. And that's why I think the law will exist in name only, but the calculus that President Obama put together, I don't think will survive very long.
Okay, seeing no more questions from the audience, Nick, I'll just go ahead and turn it back over to you to continue your line of questioning or move towards any closing thoughts you might have.
Well, I thought actually Josh had a nice summation there. I mean, I think it's we're in a difficult spot where it's impossible to move backwards, but the politics won't let us move forward. And, you know, I think what we're likely to see is a relentless slog for some time to come. I think Josh is absolutely right about that. There's a great deal to talk about. I think I'd be happy just to leave the conversation as is. Josh, do you have any final parting words?
I think the final point that I raised in the epilogue of Unraveled is we should be very careful to measure both the costs and benefits of this law. We have to acknowledge the fact that there have been about 13 million people who have gained coverage through the Medicaid expansion. That number would have been higher, but for the Supreme Court's decision in NFIB, which said, well, you can't require Texas, where I live, to join this expansion. There have been about 10 million people, who have gained coverage on the ACA exchanges. The number is hard to pin down exactly because many of them have had insurance before that they only bought new coverage because their old policies were canceled. But there are some... There is some end. There is some number of people who have benefited from this law. But on the flip side of that is that there are costs. And to use another classical liberal economist, Bastiat, there is a seen and the unseen. The costs that is not seen are people who now have higher premiums, people who have higher deductibles, people who have smaller networks, people whose actually wages at a work have gone down because now the any possible raise is now offset by health insurance coverage. There are now employers who are trying to minimize expanding coverage due to a fear of the Cadillac tax. So effectively, we're in this weird spot now where there are some people who have benefited from it, and I think there's also significant people who have actually been worse off from it, but they're much harder to pin down. And they are the forgotten man, so to speak, in the public discourse. So my single hope with this book is, if nothing else, not to prescribe a policy of how healthcare reform should be improved, to create a history and trace of how we got from point A to point B, how we got from Hillary Care in the 1990s to the Obamacare decision 2012 to now all these other big executive power comes up. The ACA has been an instrumental component of our political discourse, and the decision to do this in the fashion it was done has, I think, radically altered our political culture in ways which probably won't be realized for many decades to come.
All right. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would like to thank Josh Blackman and Nick Bagley once again for joining us. Again, Professor Blackman's book is entitled Unraveled, Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.